Some of our country's deepest divides are about sexual morality, and religion scholar Marie Griffith's latest book says that debate ultimately comes down to change versus tradition.
You know, we see over time these kind of two sides crystallizing in some way, and one of them is really very fearful that if you open up and loosen sexual morality and gender roles and things like that, ultimately America will fall apart.
Plus, more and more Americans are becoming addicted to drugs, especially opioids. So what makes for good addiction treatment? Here's Illinois Behavioral Health Association CEO, Sarah Howe.
You want to be able to talk to that provider agency directly. And I know that sounds really obvious, but what we've seen right now is that there are a lot of hotlines that have popped up. There are a lot of middle brokers.
And a documentary screening in Champaign tonight sheds light on what one state's attorney has called the biggest theft of public funds in Illinois. The case of Rita Crundwell. That's all coming up on this encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In 1969, a survey of Texas Baptists revealed that 90%, quote, felt their state's abortion law should be loosened. So when do those beliefs, about abortion in particular, become such a divisive issue when it comes to religious American life and politics? That's the topic of the latest book by Marie Griffith. She's the director of the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University, and her book is called Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. It's an exploration of gender roles, sexual identity, and how that's played out in our politics as well. We had a chance to catch up with Marie last month when she was in Central Illinois giving a lecture at the U of I. In her book, Marie argues that debates on issues like sex, sexuality, abortion rights are all really a proxy for a much larger argument about this country and change in tradition. So I started our conversation by asking her to explain that idea.
You know, if you look back really over the past century, back even to the birth control movement, you can see that these issues come up over and over again around sex and sexuality and gender. And one reason I wrote the book was to ask the question, why is that? Why are Americans constantly battling over sex in our churches and in our politics? And so exactly as you said, what I came to realize was that these aren't so much only battles over sexual morality. They're certainly that, but they're really about a fear of change versus a kind of attitude of welcoming change and progress. So, you know, we see over time these kind of two sides crystallizing in some way. And one of them is really very fearful that if you open up and loosen sexual morality and gender roles and things like that, ultimately, America will fall apart. I mean, that fear has been sort of articulated over and over again. And whereas the other side that's kind of coalesced over the years, the progressive side, is really thinking about this in terms of inclusivity, rather, and opening the door and you know, equality and justice for everyone. So you really have very competing attitudes toward change and tradition.
And there is the fear in that, and there's also the historical context. But I wonder, there's also this sort of this notion of God talk. And I do think everyone, why do you think we're so interested in Americans as we always want to claim God is on our side? Mm. And even though this is a country that's sort of founded on the separation of church and state, you write about this, that this idea of God supporting us is also something that's really important to us.
Yes. Well, and this is a theme really that goes way back in our history, a sort of American, and you know, there's a bit of hubris to it, as I think you're suggesting, that somehow we can imagine what God's will is and live that out. And I am sorry to say, I did see that over and over again among Americans in the churches who were absolutely certain of one side or the other, you know, of kind of where God stood, quote unquote, on a particular issue. And this comes, you know, for many people, it comes from their reading of the Bible or from their understanding of the history of church doctrine and other kinds of things. But it's really remarkable how certain, you know, people can be about issues that for some of us reading the Bible don't look all that certain, really.
And do you think those are related, that fear of change versus the notion that God has to be on our side?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that oftentimes the fear of change does go with a sort of sense of this is what God wants, you know, and God wants us to be sexually pure within marriage. He only wants marriage to be between one man and one woman. You know, men should sort of be the heads of the households and women sort of obeying. Of course, abortion is out of bounds. All of these kinds of ideas tend to go with a sort of certainty that these rules are in the Bible and that God has laid them down absolutely clearly, with utter clarity. And anyone who questions that is a sinner or simply deceived in their reading of the Bible and tradition.
My guest is Marie Griffith. She's the author of a book called Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. And so you talk about fear as fear of being this driving force, but then you kind of go into the different kinds of fears. And you really, I think it's not just a fear of change, but there's a couple other things going on here, including fear of people who don't look like us. Mm-hmm. And you think, how does that get reflected in all of this?
Yeah, I sort of write about three fears in particular that I kind of discern throughout all of this. The first is really a fear of women and particularly women's power, and in particular women's sexual power and sexual freedom, women's ability to sort of control their own lives, you might say. The second is a fear of sort of people who don't look like us. It's often racialized. Sometimes it's in a religious context. There's a long Protestant fear of Catholics in America, for instance, and today's big fear often is seems to be of Muslims in some quarters. And then the third is what I mentioned earlier, this fear that somehow America is going to fall into decline as a result of sexual sin, ultimately. And these three fears crop up in this stuff over and over again, and oftentimes Christian leaders are sort of stoking, I think, those fears in their people, in the pews, very effectively. And it's a very effective tool for political mobilization.
And so you write that in a historical context, the debate doesn't seem to be as intractable as it is now. Mm-hmm. And that's the crux of your work, trying to understand the historical context of this. And so as we've sort of described, almost it's almost as if there's two different religions of Christianity when you look at the right versus the left. You write that this actually stemmed from the modern day right women's rights movement. Can you take us back to that and why you think that's where this started?
Yeah, I really do sort of think it all sort of started with suffrage in a way. I don't mean that overly simplistically, but, you know, when women got the right to vote in 1920, it was a profoundly controversial thing.
When white women got the right.
White women, absolutely, right. Yes. And I do say that. I point that out
right.
In the book. But you're absolutely right. So when white women got the right to vote in 1920, it was profoundly controversial. And there were plenty of people, women and men, who did not want women's rights, did not want women to have the right to vote, thought that this was a terrible path for the country to go down. And from there, you know, these fights over gender and power and sex just escalated over time. And as you say, these aren't debates so much between religious people versus secular people, although sometimes they look like that too. But they're really deep debates within Christianity itself, within Protestant communities and Catholic communities, and then between Protestants and Catholics oftentimes. So you have this internal debate over what it means to be a Christian and what Christian morality consists of that deepens and deepens over time and comes really to define our politics in all kinds of ways.
And you think this is because this comes back to interpretations of Christianity and the role of men and women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think it comes down to women's roles, but, you know, just also a sense of should women be sexually pure? Is that crucial for sort of Christian virtue and that sort of thing? And whereas for progressive Christians, they would say those things don't matter. What matters about the Christian life is caring for the poor, seeking justice for all people, equality. It's really, you know, two very different ways of thinking about what is central to Christian faith.
And then I wanted to ask you about the racial component of mm-hmm. it. Why was it important for you to make the distinction that the women's rights, the right for women to vote was particularly around white women.
Right. So I would say that race has been a key component of all of these debates all along the way. And as we know, there's not American history is drenched in racial politics and fights about racism and racial justice and all of that. So from the very beginning, yes, part of the, frankly, the impetus against the suffrage movement was the fear that black women would also get the right to vote. And Southern Jim Crow white and white people, men and women, made that argument over and over again, you know, very vocally. So they're very open about it. But, you know, race also has mattered in the abortion debate. It mattered in the birth control debate. So the sort of fear that this opening of sexual morality, again, it's not just about women, but about the fear of sort of black sexuality, you know, oftentimes.
And so that brings us to, as we're talking about this, I can't help but think of the 2016 election. And you write that history would dictate that you think people voted for President Trump not in spite of his views of women or the stories of how he treated women, but actually because of that, including the majority of white women, the white female vote that he got. Can you explain the historical context of that?
Sure. And let me just clarify, I certainly don't mean to say that the election came down only to women and gender politics. There were many other issues, too. But I absolutely think that people who were drawn to Trump in many ways were drawn to that kind of, you know, what people interpreted at least as a kind of masculine, you know, no holds barred kind of macho personality and style of politics over and against feminism, which is what Hillary Clinton really represented. So, you know, I think that people kept asking the question, why are evangelicals supporting Trump, or why are these conservative Christians who are so consumed about sexual morality supporting a philandering adulterer who's done the kinds of things he's done? And I think part of the reason for that was there was just all this gender hierarchy bound up in that. It was about what we used to call patriarchy, right? That he's kind of just representing a kind of masculine guy that I guess some men would like to be themselves.
And women also want.
They do. I mean, that's a harder one to explain. And it was hard to explain with Roy Moore a few months later, right? And that election in Alabama, which he lost barely, but he won in the white women's vote in Alabama again. So, you know, I think it really does. There's a certain, you know, misogyny that's bound up in this. I'm sorry. I think that is just absolutely the case. And you can see it when you see the kinds of critiques that were made of Hillary Clinton. Again, the embodiment of a feminist, you know, woman who was independent and pro-choice and equal and all of that. There was a preference ultimately for the sort of Trumpian character. Regardless of morality.
So your book came out in 2017, and you write at the end of the book about the backlash to this. And I'm thinking about the Women's March, which you write about, but I'm also thinking about the many women we're now seeing running for office. Has it surprised you?
No. It's made me happy personally, because you really see this galvanizing effect, right, of people saying, wait a minute, we've been asleep here. And, you know, we need to make sure that we take a public stand in favor of women's rights, in favor of immigrants and other people that Trump was talking against and very badly about, in take a stand for African Americans and for racial justice in this country and for Black Lives Matter. So, you know, I think it's had this tremendously galvanizing effect, both in the national and local marches that have been going on around the country, but also, as you say, in candidates and voting patterns. And, you know, these midterm elections coming up are going to be really, really interesting.
And I also wanted to ask you about the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. which has also happened in the past 6 months. And we've seen this outpouring of stories of people sharing their stories of sexual assault, of sexual harassment. And that's even happening in churches. And I mentioned in particular here in Illinois, the pastor of the very popular evangelical megachurch, Willow Creek. Where do you see the Me Too movement in all of this?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, that's very interesting. The Bill Hybels story is who you're mm-hmm. referring to. And, of course, Hybels, in his sort of speech to his congregation, stood up, I believe, with his wife and his family.
He did.
And was, roundly applauded by the congregation for making such a, as they interpreted, open and honest sort of stand. And they were sort of professing their love for him. And we do often see that in evangelical church settings, a pretty quick willingness to forgive, a desire for it all to be okay, you know, and especially someone who's been as beloved and influential as Bill Hybels. But at the same time, I am very heartened by the Me Too movement. I'm heartened that women are feeling gradually empowered to tell these stories and not to feel silenced or afraid to articulate this. I think we'll see more of that as time goes on. And churches will really have to deal very openly with that across the Protestant Catholic spectrum.
Where do you think we go from here?
Well, I'd like to see more of that, of sort of open and honest discussion and debate of these sorts of things. I'd like us to have a better national conversation about feminism and what these ideals are. It worries me that sometimes younger women think that, you know, they kind of have negative associations about feminism, even when they kind of live and express feminist ideals, as I see them anyway. So I think we really do need a big national reckoning about gender justice alongside racial justice and others. And I think we are seeing the beginning of that. I'm actually hopeful.
Marie Griffith is the author, most recently, of Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. Thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. It was a lot of fun.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The number of Americans who have died from drug overdoses is on the rise. In 2016, that number was 64,000. That's 22% more than the year before, according to the New York Times. And as you've probably heard by now, opioids are a big reason that number of total drug overdoses is growing. Here in Illinois, in 2016, nearly 1,900 people died from opioid overdoses. We've talked about this crisis on the 21st before, and today we wanted to revisit a simple question. What makes for good addiction treatment? If you're trying to find effective and affordable treatment, whether it's for yourself or a loved one, what should you look for? And should you be careful about being scammed in this whole process? Sarah Howe is CEO of the Illinois Behavioral Health Association, and Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar is the Medical Director of Behavioral Health for Chicago's Department of Public Health. I spoke with both of them back in January, and I started by asking Sarah what the most important qualities are in a good addiction treatment provider.
You want to be able to talk to that provider agency directly, and I know that sounds something really obvious, but what we've seen right now is that there are a lot of hotlines that have popped up. There are a lot of middle brokers that are in between the actual agency and the patient themselves, and you don't often have the opportunity to speak directly to that provider. So the first thing I would say when you're looking is, do you have a number for the agency on their website? Can you find where they are? Are you able to pick up the phone? Are you able to ask them what kind of services they provide? What levels of care do they provide? How involved is the family? What are their expectations? Some of those basic questions, but you want to be able to talk directly to that provider agency. I think that's one of the first critical things. But you also want to know what kind of services they provide, what level of care, How do they assess somebody? In the state of Illinois, you're supposed to assess based on the American Society of Addiction Medicine, their criteria. Now, I don't expect your listeners to remember that, but the bottom line is there is a standard of care that they have to follow in terms of assessing somebody. And that means it's not a one-size-fits-all. They don't just, you don't pick up the phone and say, everybody gets a residential bed and you're always in for 28 days. That would be a red flag to me. They should talk to you about, well, we're going to assess you. We're going to determine what your best level of care is. We're going to work with you on a treatment plan. We're going to talk about what that plan looks like. And we're also going to talk about when you leave here, what's the recovery plan? Those are kind of the first things that I would look for and I'd be listening for when I'm talking to somebody on the other end of the line.
Yeah, Sarah, thanks for that. And as you mentioned that, I feel like in this, particularly in the past month or so, maybe just because I've been paying attention to it because I knew we were going to do this segment, I feel like I've seen a lot of commercials on TV. I've heard a lot of ads on the radio saying, if you need help, call these numbers. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, are those, how do we know if those are legit? Because I've seen also a lot of reporting recently about the fact that these so-called patient brokers may not be the most reputable way for people to get help.
I think that's a great question, and I don't think that we can right now here answer an across-the-board answer that would apply for all of them. I agree with everything that Sarah just stated, that really you want to be able to talk to the actual treatment provider. I will just add there are some increasing resources in the state of Illinois and in Chicago specifically to help identify local resources if that's what someone is looking for. And so two things just to let people know about. So the state of Illinois launched a helpline specifically for addiction treatment. And I can give you that number now. It's 1-833-2-FIND-HELP, and that's run by the Division of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse here in Illinois. And the city of Chicago is also, we also launched a website called overcomeopioids.org. Now, just to be clear, this website is more specific for opioid addiction information, but it actually walks through sort of the different levels of care because that's something that many people might not be familiar with, as well as the different medications that are available for opioid addiction treatment. I think it is hard. You know, when you see a commercial, you call the number, it's really hard to know the legitimacy of that site. But I think you do want to make sure that you're able to, as Sarah said, speak to the actual agency that they would be referring you to. And I think for most people, the more realistic option is that you're going to get treatment in your community or at least in your general area. And so, you know, it might behoove you to first look at the state and local resources for finding local help. And then when, you know, and if you're having trouble doing that, also potentially calling your insurance provider and seeing if they can help you identify which programs they might be working with through your own network. Those would be other options that would hopefully provide more accurate local information.
Thanks for that. And Sarah, again, that number, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about that helpline. As Dr. Salisbury Afshar was just saying, that number, and we'll repeat it a couple of times, but that number is 833-2-FIND-HELP. Again, that's 833-2-FIND-HELP. We are going to have that on our website. We'll tweet it out as well. So it'll be there for you folks. You can always remember to just go to 21stshow.org if you need that number, if you're listening and didn't have a chance to write that down. Sarah, I know sometimes when people call the hotlines that are advertised on TV or they hear on radio, sometimes they direct you to out-of-state providers. Is that another red flag as well?
That is absolutely a red flag. I'm glad you brought that up. I think one of the first red flags you hear is, well, we'll give you a flight. I've heard that numerous times, too often to count.
That sounds really,
worry, we'll
that doesn't sound
flight.
Like a good idea at all, does it? I mean,
it's one of those, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. When they're advertising the location more than the treatment, oh, you come, we're on the beach, you can play in the sand, you know, some of those things that sound great for a vacation, but not necessarily a treatment provider, that's always a red flag as well. Believe it or not, one of the other things that we're hearing is, don't worry, you can still use while you're in treatment. We have heard that from some of the patient brokers, the middle brokers from out of state. Absolutely, that's a red flag. If anybody says to you, you can come to addiction treatment and don't worry about it, you can still continue to use drugs or alcohol while you're here, that is not a reputable place. And flat out, that is a problem. We have heard all of those things. So, yes, I think what is really important is what was just said. There are good places in your community across the state, and now we do have this hotline, which is great, because the hotline itself is staffed by the Department of Human Services. They have trained individuals that are trained to do a very brief screening, not the full assessment that I talked about. That will happen, you know, within the treatment center, but a screening so that they can at least get an idea of what level of care you would be likely to receive. And from there, they can make some recommendations on what's in your area based on that level of care. And if there's a level of care that you need that's not necessarily right in your backyard, then they can give you other areas within the state of Illinois that have those levels of care, because there are multiple levels of care. It's like I've said many times before, you wouldn't walk into an oncologist office and want them to say everybody gets chemo without knowing what type of cancer you had and what stage it was. So it's the same thing when we talk about addiction treatment. You need to be assessed and have the right level of care and the right level of treatment.
Dr. Salisbury, Afshar, are you finding that there's still a great need for people to find the right information for treatment? Is it problem information or access or both?
I think it's both. I think one of the other, you know, challenges in this space is that most treatment providers aren't able to provide every level of care. And similarly, for certain substance use disorders, specifically alcohol and opioid use disorder, there are medications that can be used, but there are very few treatment providers that are able to offer all of those options. And so one thing that we see is that patients sometimes find themselves at a treatment program because their neighbor recommended it or they knew someone who went there. And, you know, there will always be an assessment component to sort of make sure that someone qualifies for services. But I think the other thing we really need to try to do a better job at as professionals is make sure that patients understand all of the treatment options and families understand all of the treatment options. And specifically around medication, we know that people who receive access to medication and behavioral supports for opioid use disorder and alcohol use disorder have better outcomes in terms of, you know, not continuing to use, the length of time that they continue to be engaged in treatment when they have access to both medication and behavioral support, although they may go to a treatment program that doesn't support the use of medication. So I think that's another really important caveat and thing to consider is to really get as much information as possible when you're thinking about what type of program you want to go to or you might want to encourage a family member to go to. And unfortunately, there still is a lot of stigma, both in the treatment community sometimes as well as in the general population around the use of medication. And so really understanding sort of what are the outcomes and how and why do people – some people do better, and that's not to say that every person with, you know, opioid or alcohol use disorder has to be on medication, but I think about it in a very similar way to how we think about treating depression or high blood pressure, that yes, some people are able to manage their depression or their high blood pressure with lifestyle change and a lot of behavioral supports and other things, and some people need medication and other support, behavioral support. And so really thinking through what are the different options and what are the outcomes and what does that individual want to try and making sure that they understand the differences in those different options and understand, again, in particular, the evidence base behind the use of medication. And then if they are interested in trying medication, going to a location that's able to offer it.
Right. And when Dr. Salisbury Afshar, when we think about medications, particularly regarding opioid addiction, what are we talking about in particular?
Yeah, so there are three medications that are FDA approved to be used for the treatment of opioid use disorder. And the first one is methadone. Methadone's been around for a really long time and has a very strong evidence base because it's been around so long. The second one, and I will just add, methadone is only available in very specific licensed opioid treatment programs is the name of the program. And so only certain types of facilities are even able or allowed to offer methadone treatment. The second medication is called buprenorphine. The more common name that people often know it by is Suboxone, but the generic name is buprenorphine. This is a medication that can often be prescribed out of an office, but is also increasingly being used in treatment settings. So, you know, a primary care office or a psychiatry office might be able to offer this form of medication. That being said, any provider that's writing a prescription for it does have to have a special license to be able to prescribe it. So not everyone that has prescribing authority can prescribe buprenorphine. And the third medication is naltrexone. And this is typically offered in the form of an injection that lasts for 1 month. And the name that people may be familiar of naltrexone, the trade name is Vivitrol. And so that one is an injection that you get once a month. And while that injection is in your system, if you use opioids on top of it, they essentially don't work. And so naltrexone is actually approved more as a relapse prevention medication as opposed to sort of a maintenance treatment, because the main thing it's doing is blocking those opioid receptors.
Sarah, can I ask about you all represent about 60 service providers across the state with the Illinois Behavioral Health Association. What areas in Illinois do you see as having the greatest need for connecting people to good treatment? Is there particular parts of the state that you think are more lacking than others?
Well, certainly in our southern counties, our more rural areas, finding a provider that's right in your backyard sometimes is not possible, but there are providers within those southern counties, western counties. We have them all across the state, but sometimes they're not necessarily within a 10-minute drive, let's say. It really depends on where you live, particularly if you are in a smaller rural county. But there are providers that you can get to, and when the state actually does their licensing, they really try to make sure that there aren't gaps where you can't get within, I want to say it's about within an hour or so to get into a provider. But providers are also doing other things like telemedicine, working in terms of telepsychiatry. If they can try to work maybe with the local hospital, they'll try to collaborate, because they do recognize sometimes even, you know, an hour away is a long trip. So if you really are in one of those farther areas where you don't have somebody right in your backyard, there are ways to work with them. And I would say that you can definitely, you know, call that provider and find out what options they have. Our website, which is ILABH, so it's the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health, ILABH.org, has our members listed by the area of the state. So that's one of the things that we do try to offer for the public, is who are available in your area. We have it listed by counties, and then we list out the actual counties that we're talking about so that you can really kind of zero in your area. But also I would say, again, from what the doctor pointed out, which is that helpline, that 1-833-2-FIND-HELP, will also, within the state, they will look for state-licensed providers, which is really critical as well, and they will find out where you live and what's available to you.
Right. Yeah, thanks for that.
Where you may have to go a little bit farther.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, Sarah. We'll have all of this information at our website.
Sure.
Sarah Howe is CEO of the Illinois Association of Behavioral Health. I want to thank also Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury-Afshar with the Chicago Department of Public Health as the medical director. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to corruption, we know that Illinois is unfortunately known for this particular type of crime, especially when it comes to government. For more than 20 years, former Dixon, Illinois comptroller Rita Crundwell embezzled almost $54 million. She lived lavishly, throwing parties, investing in horses, all while the town of Dixon, which is about 40 miles southwest of Rockford, struggled to make ends meet financially. In 2012, when Crundwell's actions came to light, she pleaded guilty and was sentenced to almost 20 years in prison. A Cartemquin film called All the Queen's Horses explores the Rita Crundwell story and the lasting effects it had on the town of Dixon.
Rita, how did you go to bed and not think whose lives I'm infecting here?
As just one of the citizens of Dixon captured by the film's director, Kelly Richmond Pope, we caught up with her back in November when the film was first released. For those of you in the Champaign-Urbana area, All the Queen's Horses is playing at the Champaign Art Theater tonight at 7:30 p.m. Back in that conversation last November, Sue Stevens from WNIJ also joined us. She reported on the Rita Crundwell case when it was happening. I started by asking the director, Kelly Richmond Pope, how she first heard about this incredible story.
Well, I first heard about it just like everyone else, reading the news in the morning, reading the newspaper, and I saw it in the Tribune, and I was like, wow, this story is amazing. And I remember the headline said $30 million embezzled by city comptroller, and I just had to know more.
And actually, of course, it got up to $54 million, actually $53.7 to be exact, and that's an enormous sum of money. And in fact, for many years, just from the period from 2006 to 2012, she actually stole half of the city's operating budget. Let's play a little bit from your film. It's one of the people that you interviewed.
My first thought was, Dixon has that much money? That you could embezzle that much money from a little tiny place like this?
Kelly, were people surprised?
People were very surprised. But, you know, it's interesting because a lot of us don't know a lot about the finances of the place that we live. And so unless you are going to city council meetings and reading financial statements, there's probably a lot that we all would be surprised about.
That's Kelly Richmond Pope. The film's called All the Queen's Horses, by the way. And Kelly, I think the first question everybody has when they hear these stories is, how could something like this happen?
Well, I think a couple things. When you have a trusted employee and you have very few internal controls, it's easy. And what's interesting about this case is it's the largest municipal fraud in U.S. history. So not just in Illinois, but just in the U.S. At large. So I think when you trust a person, you don't follow up on what they say, and you have very few internal controls, then things like this can happen. You know, I'm a CPA. And so people like to see me coming into an organization because they're like, oh, she knows the numbers and we'll leave her alone. And whatever I say or anybody like me typically goes. So when you put that much trust in any one person, be careful.
And that's not really how financial, that's kind of the whole point of financial controls, how they're set up, right, Kelly? Sue, I wonder if you can jump in here and you can just paint a picture for us. What state was Dixon in financially during the years that this fraud was going on?
Surprisingly bad. And I think one of the really the things that was stressed in this movie too that was really shocking was the city next door, Sterling, had even warned them, like, why are you guys so broke? You're just like us. We're doing fine. Why are you guys so broke? And that was ignored. Unsure what happened to that advice, but yeah, they were roads weren't getting repaired. Pools were closing. It was just the town was getting pretty shabby, and people wondered. And it was people blamed, you know, the state budget. Oh, state's not reimbursing. There are so many different ways people, you know, came up with excuses.
Well, and that's what she said, right? Sue and Kelly, yeah. I wonder if you can jump in here. She actually said at a certain point, well, we know that the state is late paying its bills, and she was taking the money.
Right. And it was during the recession. So all of that made sense. You know, that was a really good response to a great question. And when it's coming from your finance person, you accept it at face value. And we tend to do that.
And when you think about that also, so not only was that sort of a little bit of how she did it, and All the Queen's Horses, there's a very specific reason why you have that name for the film. Kelly, can you tell us how the amount of the, I mean, a really lavish lifestyle that she was living that the people in Dixon didn't know about?
Well, her two worlds really didn't communicate. So she was this number one equestrian breeder, you know, won 52 world championships. And then she had this city job, you know, so she was the comptroller. And those two worlds never really spoke. So it was easy to hide out because you didn't have a crossover between her two lives. Now, there were a lot of rumors. People wondered where her money came from. But how do you ask a question about someone's money, and who do you ask? So I don't think that people were completely clueless. What do you do when you have a question like that? Who do you really ask? You might think it might be gossip in the coffee shop, but what are you going to do with the information?
And so people didn't ask those questions. Can you, Sue, I wonder if you can jump in and say, when did the investigation actually start happening and how did this come to light?
Rita Crenwell was off on another one of her, she would take extended vacations to go show these horses. And man, she was a show woman. She loved doing this. These are very fancy horses, a lot of, a lot of money you could tell would be sunk into this. So she would go, you know, take a month off and someone would fill in for her during that time. And the person who filled in to her this time was Kathy Swanson. And when she started looking through the books, she discovered this account that nobody knew about, that she couldn't identify. It was a secret account. And that's when she went to the mayor and started to, luckily he took her seriously too and called the FBI wondering what was going on there. And then the part that's just so hard to imagine is they had to hold their tongues for 6 months.
Right.
And not tell, you know, anyone that this investigation was going on. And meanwhile, more and more money would be disappearing too.
And Kelly, so that's the Dixon City clerk, Kathy Swanson. She's really central to the film. Also, this is a really small town. Everybody knows Rita. Everyone knows each other. They knew her family. Can you describe a little bit of the role that Kathy played in all of this?
Sure. Kathy was key. And when we hear about these fraud stories or fraud schemes, after you get over the fact that someone stole the money, the next question, the second question is, well, who discovered it? And so I knew that it was really important to talk to Kathy because that's the question. Like, how was it discovered? What did you do? How did you feel? And so understanding the emotions that Kathy went through, I thought was really important. And so she becomes really the queen, if you will, of the story.
And how did you find her?
I like to say strategically stalking. I for probably 4 years. I mean, it took a long time to secure the interview with Kathy. And it was really until that interview that I felt like, yes, this is going to be a great documentary. Without Kathy, it would just have been a couple of interviews and people just, you know, sharing their story and opinion. But Kathy was key. And so the film really centers around her. It's about what Rita did. It's about her crime, but it's really centered around Kathy's courageous act of coming forward.
That's Kelly Richmond Pope. She's the filmmaker for All the Queen's Horses. We're talking with Kelly and Sue Stevens. She's a reporter with WNIJ in Rockford, pretty close to Dixon, Illinois, where all of this happened. Kelly, can we go back to Kathy for a minute? Because as you said, she's sort of the central character. And in the film, you really sort of see the emotional toll that all of this takes on her. Because we don't, when we hear about these crimes, we also, you know, you ask, as you said, you ask the questions, right? You ask, how did this happen? Who found out about it? But we don't really often talk about the emotional toll that it takes on people.
And I thought it was really important to see that. And you don't. Often the victims are left out because the perpetrator, that's where the sensational story is, you know, what they spent the money on, how they lived this lavish lifestyle. But there was a town left in pain and hurt. And so hearing from the residents and understanding Kathy's role when she kept quiet for so long, or even just turning in your superior. I mean, even just that is tough. And if you really put yourself in her shoes and think about, have you ever turned in someone that you have to report to? That's not easy. And so I thought that she was just so important. Kathy received an Ethical Courage Award from the NASBA Center for the Public Trust, received a standing ovation because everyone was happy. That's what she did.
And what else? But people are happy about what she did. How are people still feeling right now in Dixon about everything else?
I think that there were so many unanswered questions, and it made me feel really good that the documentary gave them closure and answered so many questions, because I think the reporting of this story oftentimes was so focused Rita's life, Rita's horses, look how many parties, look at the real estate, look at the jewelry she had. But there was such a larger story that needed to be told. And so they asked questions. We had a Q&A after the screening. I think the first night it was like an hour, hour and a half.
Well, what kind of reaction? What was the tone of that?
So the main two questions were, do I think that there were any co-conspirators? Do I think that she did it alone? And all the evidence shows that the scheme was committed alone, but there were definitely people that benefited from the monies that she stole, but she committed the crime by herself. So that was one question. The other question was, did I think she received a fair sentence? She received 19 years and 7 months in prison. There were questions about what an audit does, versus what an audit doesn't do. And it was good, you know, just to explain some of those things. And I'm an accounting professor by training. So to be able to have people ask me those questions and be able to explain it in a clean, easy way made me feel like the film is doing the right thing.
As we talk about that, we have a little bit more. Let's hear a little bit of that.
This is the defendant's trophy room. Not many people have a herd of 400 show horses, many world champion horses. Our interest would be to try to get all $53 million. I don't know that the herd's ever going to bring anything close to that. Our purpose today is to let the prospective buyers know that what we have here is a very valuable herd.
So that's a moment where officials are trying to sell the horses that she bought, millions of dollars worth of horses, in order to try to help get some money back to the town of Dixon. Sue, are they even close? I mean, what does the recovery look like in terms of recovery efforts financially?
They didn't do too badly. About $40 million, and a lot of that came from suing auditors and people who should have been able to stop it. But a lot of, I think it was about $10 to $12 million came from auctioning off her stuff. These horses, the one that sold for the most was $750,000. But I was there that day, and it was just horse after horse. It was just an amazing thing to get to experience and see and understand. This is where Dixon's money was going, was sinking into these horses and the breeding of these horses. You know, she still actually makes money off the licensing of these horses. That one that brought in $775,000 has since died, but his sperm lives on and they keep selling it. So
wow.
It's just a very different world. But what I really loved, I was at that first showing with that Kelly did in Dixon, and the way the audience, I think people went into it trepidatiously.
Absolutely.
You know, they were, you know, here we go again. Some, you know, the world's going to beat us down for being dumb hicks, you know, who could lose this kind of money. But you did it so respectfully. And like you said, they had questions about the process. And it was really nice to see the warm reaction that you got from the audience for this film.
I was excited. I was nervous. I can tell you I was nervous because, you know, it's me. I'm an outsider.
You're from Chicago.
You know, I'm telling this story. But what I wanted them to realize is we're using Dixon as a lens to have a much larger conversation about how this can happen anywhere. This isn't a Dixon story. This is an everywhere, anybody story. And so I hope that that came through when they
Absolutely.
Saw the film.
I want to thank both of you ladies for being with me, Kelly Richmond Pope, Sue Stevens as well from NIJ in DeKalb. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
It was great. Thanks.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. on our Facebook page. Search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.